From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
And the vision that was planted in my brain still remains within the sound of silence.
Silencio. Silencio. Silencio.
In space, no one can hear you scream.
I need the noises of destruction.
You love the noise. You hate it, but you love hating it.
Whispering the sounds of silence.
As you can probably tell from that mashup, we're going to explore quiet and silence today. George Mickelson Foy will tell us about his search for absolute silence, and we'll explore one of the things that inspired Foy to seek out silence, our country's reputation as loud America. Also one of the most misunderstood pieces of music ever written, John Cage's 433. But first, a few questions for you. Do you prefer one-on-one conversations to group activities? Would you rather express yourself in writing than talking? Do you feel drained after being out and about, even if you've enjoyed yourself? Those are just three of 20 questions designed to see where you land on the introvert-extrovert spectrum. This quiz is from Susan Cain's best-selling book, Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking. Why did Susan Cain write Quiet?
I really wrote the book for an analogous reason to how women started to write books about sexism, you know, back in the 1950s and 1960s. I believe that introverts today are where women were back then, which is to say we're talking about probably half of the population, according to recent studies. Half the population is introverted, and that's a half the population that is discounted because of a trait that goes to the core of who they are. And this bias against introversion in our culture, it causes psychic pain for individual introverts, but I also believe it is a loss for the culture at large, and that we're designing our schools and our workplaces solely for extroverts, not for introverts, and that that's leading to a real waste of talent and energy and happiness. You know, I think one of the best ways to understand it is to really get at what actually is the difference between introverts and extroverts. It really has to do with how we respond to stimulation. Introverts tend to feel at their most alive and at their most energized when they're in environments that are less stimulating, when there's sort of less stuff coming at them, whereas extroverts really crave lots of stimulation coming at them to feel at their most alive. And if they don't get it, they start to feel kind of bored and listless and just, you know, not generally happy. So it's important to understand in this way, because introverts sometimes are perceived as being asocial or wimpy. And it's really not that. It's just this desire for less stimulation. So this is why, you know, socially introverts would usually rather sort of interact one-on-one, have dinner with a close friend, as opposed to going to a party.
So introversion is not the same thing as shyness, which many people would think.
That's right. It's not. Shyness is about the fear of social judgment. A shy person tends to imagine that people are judging them negatively, even when they're not. And introversion has nothing to do with that. It's this preference for less stimulation. Now, in practice, some introverts are shy and some are not. So the two do overlap to some extent, but psychologists can't even really agree on to what extent. There are definitely plenty of introverts out there who are not shy at all. A good example, I think, would be somebody like a Bill Gates. People routinely describe as introverted. He has a very private, kind of understated style about him. But he doesn't seem like he's shy. You know, he doesn't seem like he's overly fazed by what people think of him.
And then there is something that you call an ambivert.
Yeah.
I'm guessing from the title that it means in between. But that's interesting, because how do you come up with a definition for it? How do you describe it?
Yeah, you know, it's a tricky thing. The technical definition would really be somebody who is kind of smack in the middle of the introvert-extrovert spectrum. And I get a lot of people telling me, you know, I feel like I'm both. And so I guess that's what an ambivert is. The reason I say it in such provisional terms is because these terms are just famously mushy. And all of us have some of the other style in us, right? Even Carl Jung, the psychologist who first popularized these terms, introversion and extroversion, even he said there's no such thing as a pure introvert or a pure extrovert. He said such a man would be in a lunatic asylum. To some extent, we're all ambiverts. And yet, I think for many people, we do feel like we do recognize ourselves as largely belonging to one end of the spectrum or the other, even if we have times where we step out of our characteristic mode.
Here we are in the early part of the 21st century, and we are, I think you'd have to say, in the middle of what you describe as an extrovert ideal culture.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to be the best person you can be, you'd better learn how to be an extrovert, I guess is the way you'd define that.
You'd better learn how to be out there to some degree, but I do think that many successful introverts figure out ways to negotiate that in ways that are quite natural to them. They learn sort of quieter forms of presentation that are equally effective. And I should also say that social media is actually turning some of this on its head in interesting ways because, you know, of course, you now, through Twitter or Facebook or whatever, you now have the ability to express yourself and to connect with large numbers of people without actually leaving your house. So that's a whole twist on things.
Yeah. What are the dangers, do you think, of this bias toward extroversion that we're seeing in our culture?
The first danger really is kind of psychic danger to introverts. I've spoken now to hundreds, to thousands of introverts, and I hear again and again this sense of I don't feel okay being who I am because from the time they are children, very young children, they are sent the message that there is something wrong with their longing to have more solitude, with their longing to connect in these quieter ways. And so many, you know, walk around feeling a sense of being flawed. And also, they kind of lose their sense of how they prefer to spend their time. So, you know, people who might really prefer to spend their Saturday nights reading or studying or being creative or doing God knows what, they instead sort of propel themselves out to parties because they feel that's what they're supposed to be doing. So that's kind of the first thing. But, you know, I think more broadly than that, we have entire workplaces that are designed primarily for extroverts. Now, if you're a manager, how does that make sense, really? You'd be much better off cultivating the morale and the energy of your entire workforce and trying to set things up in a way that works for both.
If you want new ideas, you'd think you'd turn to not the people who can shout the loudest, but the people who can think the loudest, if you will.
Yeah, and that's introverts and extroverts. You know, this isn't to say introverts, they're the only ones who can think. It's just to say that we need both people's brains. And we have a system that is designed to cultivate more the brains of extroverts than the brains of introverts, which is a mistake because they do think differently. I mean, introverts tend to think before they speak. Extroverts think while they speak. Extroverts tend to be really good at stuff like multitasking. Introverts are really good at tasks that require more depth and more sitting and focusing on a problem at length. So the two types do have their different strong suits, and we're best off cultivating them both.
Well, let's talk about introversion and children, because it's important. I mean, people often think we can mold young people to be who we think they need to be. But we really ought to be paying more attention to their nature, shouldn't we? I mean, whether they're introverted or extroverted, and maybe shaping the teaching experience to help them with their nature.
Absolutely. This is a tremendous problem. You know, I hear all the time from people, I'm talking about people now in their 50s and 60s and 70s who write me letters about things that happened to them when they were children in school, remarks the teachers made about how they weren't speaking enough in class or this kind of thing. And these remarks really sting because the children understand that they are being told that the person that they are, that the way that they are, that their way of being is wrong and that they need to change. That's a big thing to tell a kid. And these kids really are who they are. That's not to say that introverted children can't learn over time, you know, certain skills that will help them in this extroverted society of ours. But it is to say that we need to be cultivating these kids for who they are instead of telling them you have to turn into somebody else.
Is that harder for one kind of parent than another? I mean, is an introverted parent likely to have more trouble with an extroverted child or vice versa?
No, actually not. You know, I think there are different challenges that come up depending on what the pairing is. But any kind of parent can be great with any kind of child. And in fact, you know, sometimes introverted parents can have a unique trouble when they have introverted children, which is they might remember the difficulties that they faced when they were young and kind of project them onto their children. Whereas an extroverted parent doesn't have that whole set of memories that they're bringing to the table. So for an extroverted parent, the challenge is to really understand who the child is. And not to, what I always say is, not just understand that child, but really delight in that child. You know, because these introverted children, they tend to be very perceptive. They tend to make really loyal friends. They tend to have fascinating, creative inner lives. They're very conscientious. They have a whole unique constellation of gifts that they are bringing to the table that other children don't have. And the more you can really start from a place of delighting in it, the better off you are. You know, and from there, you can start teaching the child ways of coping in a world that might not be as easy for them as it would be for a more extroverted kid.
So where does this come from? I know you've done a fair amount of study exploring neurobiology and psychology of introverts and extroverts. Is this a genetic issue? What have you learned?
There is actually a ton of stuff out there on this. It's fascinating. Introversion and extroversion are among the most heritable of all personality traits. So, you know, it's a mixture of nature and nurture like anything else, but there's a huge genetic component to it. What psychologists have found is that there is a particular temperament that some babies are born with that predisposes them more to be shy or to be introverted. It's a temperament that is more sensitive to stimulation of all kinds. Because you're more sensitive to stimulation, you're paying more attention to everything going on in your environment, and you're reacting more to it. So this is why these kids, when they're, let's say, 2 years old, you throw them into a playgroup of kids they've never met before, they're going to take their time more before entering that playgroup than another child would, because their temperament is saying to them, okay, there's all this new stimuli coming at you. You've got to sit still and figure out what's going on before you plunge ahead. Whereas extroverted children are just going to plunge. They're not going to feel the stimulation coming. You can actually see this from the moment these kids are born. If you give babies sugar water to suck on, you will see that some babies will suck more vigorously on the sugar water than others will. And the babies who suck more are the ones who are more likely to be introverts, because what they're doing is they are reacting more to the stimulus of that sugar coming at them.
I was just sitting here wondering whether it's easier to be an introvert and be forced to be a little more extroverted than it is to be an extrovert and be asked to be more introverted.
Such a good question. I think it's equally difficult. You know, it's difficult for any human to be told to act in a way that's not natural, right? Now, it's also part of having maturity to be able to stretch yourself and to act in ways that are not natural. And I think extroverts do need to do this all the time, the way introverts do. If you're an extrovert, you might have to sit still for a long time and write a memo or a book, you know, whatever you're working on, even when you might prefer to be like up and down the hallways chatting with your colleagues. So we all have to do that some of the time. The real issue is when you're made to do it all the time, or when you feel like you have to do it all the time. That's when issues of burnout and that kind of thing set in.
Susan Cain is the author of Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking. Do you think of yourself as an introvert or an extrovert? If you're not sure, you can take a quiz on Susan Cain's website. You'll find a link to it on our website, ttbook.org. Do you agree with Cain? Is our society biased toward extroverts? And does this hurt introverts and society as a whole? You can share your thoughts with us by sending email to our website or via Facebook. You'll find links to our Facebook page and to our Twitter account on our website, ttbook.org. It's always nice to hear from you. Coming up, George Mikkelsen Foy on Zero Decibels, The Quest for Absolute Silence, as we continue our hour on quiet. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Million Americans suffer from environment-related deafness, according to the Environmental Protection Agency. So it's only natural that some people would look for relief from this never-ending, omnipresent cacophony while they're still able to hear anything. One of those people is George Mikkelsen Foy. He's the author of Zero Decibels, The Quest for Absolute Silence. He talks with Anne Strange Champs about his efforts to track down silence. But first, He reads an excerpt from his book that explains why he embarked on his quest. It was something that happened while Foy was standing on a subway platform in Manhattan.
That day, however, just as the downtown local was coming to a halt, the uptown local came in, and at the same instant, the downtown express entered the station, its seven burgundy-colored cars thundering, shrieking, roaring at 40 miles per hour between the slowing locals. Immediately thereafter, the uptown express, as if anxious not to miss the party, showed up around the curve from 72nd Street and blasted into a station already occupied by three other trains, two moving, one now stopped. The noise was immense. It was gut-pounding. It smacked the cosmos. Without thinking, I clamped the flat of my palms to both ears and screwed my face into the scrunched expression of a root canal patient. I usually despise people who do that on subway platforms. Wimps, I think. Milquetoast souls who cough if someone is smoking across the street, who wear cardigans and bicycle clips. For God's sake, if you're so delicate, move to an ashram. But here I was, doing the same thing. And still the noise grew. As the express trains slammed past each other in the stone tunnel, and the flanges of their wheels rocked 45 tons of weight against the edge of rail, the whine of motors, the warning dings as the door of the downtown local closed and ours opened, the grunts and plaints of sardined passengers, and the overamped voice of the conductor yelling, 79th, let the passengers off! Stand clear of the closing doors! I remember keeping my hands power glued to my ears, even as we boarded and sat down. My daughter Emily, who is a teenager, is always alert to signs of egregious weirdness on the part of her progenitors, glanced at me nervously. But for once, something had cracked the enamel coating New Yorkers must accrete to live in this town, and I kept my ears covered, cringing at the rumble that filtered through my palms, thinking, I can't put up with this kind of noise day in, day out, any longer. I mused, this has to damage me in some way, and reflected also, because that was the other wheel of this scooter of thought, I need to find somewhere quiet. And the train rumbled slower and stopped, and the loudspeaker blatted, 86, let him off! And I thought, no, not just quiet. What I want now is silence. Perfect silence. No noise, no sound, nothing. I came to think of the city as having this monster breath. If you listen, even at 3 or 4 a.m., stick your head out the window and listen, you hear this constant sound, this huge organism breathing all the time.
And you also traveled to Colorado to talk with David Night Eagle, the Pine Ridge Lakota. And this is thinking more about cultural silence. What did you find there?
I was looking into, as you said, cultural silence. The fact that in Western culture, and especially Western American culture, we're very much conditioned to be suspicious of silence. There have been studies done that show that when somebody doesn't talk much or is not very forthcoming with what they say or allows a lot of silence, essentially, in their interaction, we view them with suspicion. They're seen as sly and untrustworthy. However, among a lot of American Indian cultures, the opposite is the case, where people are conditioned, essentially, to allow a lot of respectful silence in their interactions. When the Lakota, for example, talk in council, there's a very defined pause at the end of each person's contribution to the conversation, and that pause is respected. And in fact, nobody will talk until somebody has something to say, which is not a bad rule to go by, generally speaking, but I think we're conditioned kind of to do the opposite. The Apache, the Ute, the Sioux all have this way of being. So I went there to interview David Night Eagle, who's a flute maker and a musician and somebody who's talked a lot about and written about the kind of music that the American Indian make and the importance of silence in terms of making music and in terms of allowing the environment around them to influence what they're doing. And I met a number of Ute especially who were part of his community, and we talked a lot about that. It was just very interesting because not just what they said, but the fact that they talked the way they were supposed to, in a sense. They were very, very respectful and very respectful of the silence between sentences, the silence between ideas, and allowing people plenty of time and quiet to think and to contribute what they had to contribute to the conversation.
That must have made you, I don't know, come home and begin to think about even conversation differently. Did you feel that you'd almost tuned your ears to listen differently?
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's one lasting effect of this quest, was that I do think about every aspect of my life differently. I think about it in terms of not only of what I have to say and the noise that I have to make to sell my books or to tell my kids something, but also the flip side of that, which is what I have to say is not only defined by the ideas that structure the words that I'm coming out with, but it's also defined by the silence that and the space that I leave around those ideas and those words, and the ability to listen that implies. And also there's a greater structure that happens. I think when you think about the pauses between what you say, the pauses that happen in music, the pauses that you allow in your life, there's something else that happens. Our lives are very much defined by rhythms. There have been studies done that show that we tend to work in cycles of 15 or 20 minutes, after which our energy and our attention flags a bit. We actually need, apparently, organically, a downtime at that point. I think silence works into that in ways that we don't yet fully understand.
That's fascinating. So we're physically designed to need silence, to need the pauses.
That seems to be the case. And I think some of the playwrights and artists who have used a lot of silence in their work have understood this organically. One of my favorite playwrights is Harold Pinter, and my actor's friends call him Harold Pause Pinter because he puts so many pauses in his work. He and Beckett both generated these plays that are incredibly tense because there is so much space and silence packed around the words that, by definition, the actors and the people watching them have to pay way more attention to what is finally being said after those pauses, after that silence, after that tension has mounted, and after you've had time to kind of absorb everything around them, because people aren't actually saying something right at that moment.
You're sort of suggesting that silence is not so much a negative. It's not just the absence of sound in and of itself. It's maybe a thing itself.
Can you feel yourself really waiting for me to talk right there? It is. I think it is. I think we're going to come to a greater understanding of that as we understand more about our own rhythms and the way we process information and how much I think we need to take time to understand what we're doing, understand, especially in this society, how huge the amount of information we're expected to see, listen to, digest, absorb, use. Actually, absolutely unprocessable amounts, and yet we're subjected to just tremendous amounts of data, visual, oral, and so forth. And I think the society is going to, at some point, ascribe way more importance to stopping that for a moment or an hour or what have you, enough time to be able to readjust our lives, to analyze what's come in, to cut away stuff that we don't need from this massive overdose of information, and then to go on with a more balanced rhythm, with maybe more balanced thought process, because we've taken time off from being subject to all this noise, to all this information.
Along your quest, you searched out the quietest place on Earth, and this is a laboratory in Minneapolis?
Yeah, it's actually a sound studio plus lab, and it's a wonderful place. And the owner, Steve Orfield, is just this wonderful forward-thinking, free-thinking guy. Within the Orfield Lab sound studio, there's an anechoic chamber, which is the best in the world in terms of just cutting out all noise, cutting out all sound.
What's an anechoic chamber?
Well, it's kind of like what it sounds like, that sort of an is being the Greek for no or not, and there's no echoes because there's no sound. It's three concentric cubes of steel and concrete. And within the innermost cube, the walls are completely covered with sound-absorbent material. You know, the doors are thick, kind of battleship-type doors. And it's rated to minus 9.4 decibels. 0 decibels is kind of the quietest noise that anybody can hear at that level. This is rated to about 10 times less than that. And that only makes sense in instrument terms, because instruments can pick up what the human ear can't. The Guinness Book of Records rates it as the quietest place on Earth.
And this is a place that supposedly humans actually have a hard time withstanding?
Yeah, there apparently were instances of people going in there and kind of freaking out because they're not used to it.
You went in though, right?
I did. And apparently there was something called the Orfield Challenge, whereby if anybody could stand being in there for 45 minutes with no sound, total darkness, and so forth, they would get a case of Guinness, which had something to do with the Guinness Book of World Records, I think. But I went in there, and I went in there for 45 minutes. And far from freaking out, I actually loved it. I guess I was sort of the right person to love it because I was looking for total silence. I was looking for an absolute, even if it didn't exist, and that was as close as I will ever come to it before I croak. And it was wonderful. When I went in there and they shut off the lights, because lights actually can produce a little bit of a buzz, and they closed the doors, and I was there in total darkness on this kind of spring-loaded grid work because a floor would creak if you walked on it. And for a few seconds there, it was just wonderful. I felt as if I'd found the grail. It was like this bubble, this conceptual bubble, because within the bubble there was nothing, and that's the only way I could visualize it.
What did you do for the, like, 45 minutes in there? Did you just sit and listen to the silence? Did you move around?
Well, the total silence, my feeling of total silence, only lasted a few seconds. And then, of course, I became aware that I was making sound breathing. So I tried stopping that for a little while. But when I stopped breathing, then I became very aware of my heartbeat. And when I tried to listen kind of between my heartbeats, I heard other things. I could hear my pulse, which isn't quite the same as my heartbeat because it makes noise in other parts of the body.
You could hear your pulse.
Yeah, it was amazing. If I frowned, I could hear while I was concentrating on hearing nothing. If I frowned, I could hear the sound of my scalp rubbing over my skull, which is a bit eerie.
I'm frowning now. I don't hear anything.
No. Well, you're listening to me. On top of it all, there was another sound that didn't seem to equate with either the heartbeat or the pulse or the breathing or anything else that I could figure out. It was this kind of rhythmic scraping sound that happened. The only thing I could think of was, having grown up in a waterfront area, there's a kind of dredge called a bucket dredge that just rhythmically clanks around and scrapes mud off the bottom of the harbor and dumps it into a barge. And that kind of rhythmic, rusty, metallic clanking was what it sounded like. And I never figured out what it was. I have a good idea what it was, which is a form of tinnitus. But I spent a good part of the time trying to figure that out, and then fairly obsessively at first. And then after a while, I just tried to enjoy it. I walked around a bit trying to see if I was disoriented, because some people are disoriented due to the proximity of the inner ear balance system and the outer ear hearing system. Apparently, they affect each other to some extent. So I wanted to see if I was disoriented by total sensory deprivation.
And were you?
No, I don't think so. Not really. Except, obviously, I couldn't see what I was doing or where I was going, but there was a chair there that I could use as an anchor. Mm-hmm. And then I just enjoyed it. I sort of tried to parse the different levels of my own breathing, and I tried to sort of analyze my heartbeat, and I tried to hear the silence in between, because I knew that was as close as I was going to get to total silence in my life.
George Mikkelsen Foy is the author of Zero Decibels, The Quest for Absolute Silence. He spoke with Unstrange Champs. It was the perfect venue for such a momentous musical event, although it wasn't chosen for that reason. It was just one of those happy accidents that the piece's creator may have enjoyed. The Maverick Concert Hall. It's an open-air theater just south of Woodstock, New York. It's designed to blend in with its natural environment. On the evening of August 29th, 1952, the pianist David Tudor made history by performing the premiere of John Cage's 433. Kyle Gann is the author of No Such Thing as Silence, John Cage's 433. He tells Steve Paulson what happened that night.
The next to last piece was 4 minutes and 33 seconds. Tudor just, without any explanation, just sat down. According to him and Cage, he lowered the lid on the piano keys. Other people say he raised it at the beginning. But he seems to have lowered the lid and then raised it a couple of times to mark the three movements of the piece and then quit. And it's a little unclear what happened next, because there was one more piece on the program, Henry Cowell's The Banshee, which is a very odd little piece that's played entirely inside the piano. There's no real documentation on whether the Cowell got played, but there was a question and answer session after the performance, and people got very irate and stood up and shouted, and somebody finally yelled, "Good people of Woodstock, let's run these people out of town." Most of the audience should have known what they were getting into, but there were apparently quite a few vacationing members of the New York Philharmonic present.
So from the audience's perspective, they must have thought, here was this pianist sitting up there doing nothing for 4.5 minutes, and then he finishes, and they want to call this art?
Yeah, pretty much. The idea of a composer taking credit for something he didn't actually do.
David Tudor never actually touched the piano keys, right?
Right.
What did he do?
Well, Tudor says afterward, he turned pages. Because the score was originally written out on several pages, and for Tudor, he said it was very important to him. He didn't use a stopwatch the way most people do. The tempo was supposed to be quarter note equals 60, and he simply counted the right number of beats. And as they would go by, he'd turn the page. And he thought that was the only authentic way to perform it.
Mm-hmm. You said that it got outraged reaction by some people sitting in the audience. What about the press? When word got out about this bizarre piece of music, what was written about it?
Its reputation took off rather slowly. It was really not well known for a long time. The New York premiere took place 2 years later. It got two reviews. One of them just dismissed it as kind of the usual downtown bohemian exhibitionism. The other was kind of bemused and tolerant. It's gotten lots of mixed press ever since, although I was really impressed when Cage died, how many critics wrote in their obituaries, wrote about that as his most striking piece, and really seemed to understand what it was about.
You write that John Cage's 433 is one of the most misunderstood pieces of music ever written, and yet also one of the avant-garde's best understood. Can you explain what you mean?
It's very widely misunderstood by people who aren't familiar with the whole context, even at that time by some who were. It was seen as something kind of cheeky and arrogant.
Just a joke. I mean, he was going to get up there and thumb his nose at the music establishment.
Right. Given some of the initial impetus behind the piece, I think there is something of a joke aspect of it. He first got the idea as a response to Muzak, because in the 1940s, composers and musicians of that time were really, really horrified by the advent of Muzak and what it was doing to the way people listened and the way it was imposing music on people and taking away people's quiet. And so the original idea was to write a 4.5 minute piece of Muzak, because 4.5 minutes was the longest thing you could get on a 78 RPM record, and that's what Muzak used at the time, to sell to the Muzak company so that people could get 4.5 minutes of silence. It's hard to say that that's not a joke. He didn't really go through with the piece until 4.5 years later, when he had decided it was more than a joke. There was an actual joke. There was a student at the time who got in the newspaper for his plan to make silent records for jukeboxes so that people who didn't want to listen to jukeboxes could put in a quarter and buy a few minutes of respite from them.
Is that what Cage was after? I mean, he'd been thinking about this idea for years, right?
He had.
Doing a piece that was silent, yet maybe not totally silent.
There were so many different things that led him to it. He was influenced by the white paintings of Robert Rauschenberg. Robert Rauschenberg just painted some canvases white, and in Cage's idea, that meant that they would accept whatever shadows or lint or dirt got onto them, which was his idea of environmental noise. It was a response to having gone into the anechoic chamber at Harvard and heard that most of the time there is no such thing as silence, even your body makes noises, and so you can't really escape hearing something.
Now, this is the echo-free chamber at Harvard that's supposed to be totally silent, and yet apparently it's not, because you hear your own body?
Right.
What do you actually hear in your own body?
Well, the technician told Cage that he was hearing his blood circulating and his nervous system in operation. There's been some doubt placed on that since then. It seems more likely that Cage probably had tinnitus, as most musicians do by a certain point. He was hearing that. And that's what was interpreted as being his nervous system in operation.
Why was that experience so influential for Cage?
Well, it probably wouldn't have been, except that he had been, for the last few years, getting interested in Zen and the Zen idea of not making distinctions between one thing or another, accepting all reality as being pretty much the same thing. And so he was very open at that point to the idea of all sounds that you heard having the same significance as the music you were listening to. he saw a big, big division in the history of music coming with the advent of electronic tape, because he said, now with tape, you could put any sounds into music, you could make any rhythms, you could make any pitch continuum, that music had now opened up to include everything, and that so there was no reason in his mind to separate off the sounds coming from the loudspeakers in a tape piece from the sounds that weren't coming through the loudspeakers.
So somehow this was liberating for him, this idea. I mean, it was sort of breaking the distinction between music and the rest of the world that generates sound.
Mm-hmm. Some of it had to do with Eastern thought. He was very influenced by a writer, Ananda Kumaraswamy, who was the curator of fine arts at the Boston Museum, one of the world's leading authorities on Eastern art. Kumaraswamy wrote a lot about how in other cultures there is not this separation of art from everyday life, that it plays a part of it, that every implement people use in certain cultures is an artistic product, that you just live your life artistically and everything you do has to do with art some way or another. And Cage was trying to bring that into a Western consciousness.
Now, I think most people, when they hear about John Cage's piece 433, they see this as an exercise in silence.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not totally that, is it?
No.
The performer might be, I don't know if he's making actually any sound as he's, you know, lifting the piano cover up and down off the keys. I mean, you can hear the ambience in the room as well. I mean, for Cage, those things mattered, right?
Yes, they did. Cage's idea of the piece changed so much throughout his life, and he later said that he performed 4 minutes and 33 seconds every day for long periods of time. He actually removed the title from the piece and said it could be as long as you wanted it to be, and said it was something he listened to every day. But it's impossible to subtract from the piece the theatrical aspect of its premiere and its early performances, with, you know, the idea that somebody sitting on stage, everyone expects they're going to play, and they don't play. And that is the aspect of the piece that relates to Dada, the Dadaist movement around World War II, when people were doing, you know, like Marcel Duchamp taking a normal men's urinal and signing his name onto it as a work of art. It's a very similar kind of gesture. It seems to me really important to the identity of the piece that it actually is in three movements.
Why?
Because there's a kind of framing mechanism to it which kind of makes it a piece of classical music. No other tradition has pieces in three movements except for European classical music. It makes it a little bit like a sonata in three movements.
Does this piece matter in the long history of music or in the way we think about art?
I've read in a couple of places that people say it is the best-known piece of American classical music, which is an odd thought, even better than like Copland's Appalachian Spring. I think you would have to put Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue in front of that, probably. It not only matters, it has mattered a lot more than most avant-garde music has mattered. I couldn't keep track of the number of rock albums that, quote, covered 433. I published a list of them, and as soon as the book came out, I found out about six or eight more.
Kyle Gann is the author of No Such Thing as Silence, John Cage's 433. He spoke with Steve Paulson. And you are listening to John Cage's 433. What do you think of it, John Cage's 433? You can let us know by sending us email through our website at ttbook.org, or you can contact us via Facebook or Twitter. You'll find links to our Facebook page and Twitter account on our website. It's always nice to hear from you. Coming up, we'll explore the flip side of quiet, noise, as we conclude our Hour on Quiet. I'm Jim Fleming. That's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. We can't really talk about quiet and silence without talking about its opposite, noise. Garrett Kaiser is the author of The Unwanted Sound of Everything We Want, a book about noise. Kaiser tells Steve Paulson, it's hard to come up with a precise definition of noise. It's not just unwanted sound.
Well, like all definitions, it only goes so far. It's a definition that really grew out of electronic technology, engineers distinguishing signal from noise, noise being unwanted sound. I prefer to think of noise as any sound that interferes with the full exercise and enjoyment of life. And I won't just say human life, since noise also affects the lives of animals. Noise also affects other sounds. It's a commonplace to make a binary out of noise and silence, and then also to assign values, and noise stands for wickedness and silence stands for good. I have difficulty with that for a number of reasons, and I prefer to think of noise not as the enemy of silence, but as the enemy of a whole lot of other sounds that I enjoy, that most of us enjoy, and that I think are essential to a full human life, such as conversation. Hmm. Our human voices evolved at a decibel level in a world that did not contain jackhammers and supersonic jets and could usually be counted on to be heard over just about anything but an erupting volcano. That's no longer the case.
And I think a lot of us, if you were to ask us, so what is noise? You know, we could rattle off a bunch of things, loud planes, highway traffic noise, music blaring loudly, jackhammers. Are there other kinds of noise that might go under the radar that are just as insidious but that we tend not to think about?
Well, context is going to determine a lot of what you regard as noise. And another thing that interested me about the subject is that, like human beings themselves, noise has, you know, a subjective and an objective component. You can measure sound. But what makes a sound a noise has a certain subjective quality to it. You might not consider the sound of your blender to be a noise because it's your blender and you're making your drink with it, but perhaps the stereo system coming from the house across the way you would regard as noise. So context determines, and a number of subjective factors will determine what we regard as a noise.
Coming back to this notion then of whether it's wanted or not. So one person's music, which gives that person joy, might really bother someone else.
Yes, it might. And that needs to be acknowledged. At the same time, the disingenuousness of claiming that that subjectivity therefore renders the whole issue of noise pollution and noise annoyance moot also needs to be acknowledged so that someone says, well, it may be noise to you, but it's music to me, and vice versa. Well, that depends on some other factors, such as a community's reasonable expectations of being able to sleep at night and factors like that.
So partly what you're talking about is noise intrudes on our personal space, our sense of solitude, our sense of well-being.
Yes, and each of us is usually pretty good at recognizing that. When we're on the receiving end, we are less good, and I'm including myself in we, in recognizing how some of our activities may affect others. The passenger in business class who's sitting in the plane and it's quiet and it's nice and there's a drink on the arm of the chair and his iPad is open and he's quietly doing some work before his next big meeting doesn't hear the noise of the little shoebox house that's near the airport because that's the only place where the real estate's affordable for the person who lives there and who lives with that sound every single day. So I think when we explore noise annoyance, if we don't get beyond our own particular annoyance at specific sounds that we single out, we can become very close to cranks and nothing more. A thoroughgoing exploration of noise includes recognizing our effects on others and how our excesses sometimes affect people who barely have minimum
Well, and you're also suggesting there are always power relationships involved here, and one quality of having social status or economic status is you can insulate yourself from other people's noise, and those who are powerless can't. I mean, they tend to live in very noisy environments.
That's right, and that's been demonstrated by surveys and censuses. But historically, yes, power confers the privilege of being able to make noise, but it also confers the ability to silence other people's sounds, which are regarded as noise. In the Middle Ages, there was an ordinance in one city requiring that all services coming from synagogues be said in a low voice so as not to disturb the sensibilities of Christian neighbors. And that's a majority deciding what's noise, and noise, as is often the case in history, is whatever issues from the mouths or the instruments of a minority.
How does this play out in our society today? How powerless people tend to be subjected to noise?
Well, they're subjected to noise in any number of ways. They're subjected to it because their residences are often located in noisy places and noisy parts of the city next to noisy transportation sources. I think the leading source of noise in the world is transportation, and so you have people who are located next to airports, they're located next to highways. So noise plays out in that way. You know, noise affects one's ability to sleep. But also, I think the poor and the marginal are often affected indirectly by some assumptions we have about noise. So we make up this mythology that if you're poor or you're a member of a certain ethnic group, you sort of like noise. You know, them people don't need to sleep the way us people do.
Now, one of the chapters in your book is called Loud America, and there is this perception that we in America are especially loud. And I guess I'm curious whether that's true. I mean, are Americans noisier than people from other countries?
Well, I don't know if that is so, only because I have traveled, but I don't think I've traveled extensively enough to make a blanket statement. But we are a prosperous nation relative to other nations. And with prosperity, there does come the means for making noise, not only the literal noise, the acoustic noise that comes from aircraft, that comes from military weapons, but also the noise that comes with power, the ability of a dominant culture to drown out the low decibel strains of other people's cultures, languages, music, etc.
And of course, this is again where money comes into play. You know, if you're rich enough, it's easier for you to buy some quiet.
That's right. Silence and quietness are forms of wealth. And like other forms of wealth, they are not distributed equally or justly, in my opinion.
So given all this research that you did, I mean, looking into noise from all kinds of different dimensions, including the social and political dimensions, and recognizing that this is a bigger problem than most of us realize, what can we do about it? How should we think about noise in a different way?
Well, there are a number of things I think that we can do about it. First of all, we can recognize that it is a problem, that it is a health problem, and that, like other health problems, it affects people disproportionately. Second of all, I think we can become a little less sheep-like. We like to associate in America noise with being rebellious, you know, with being some kind of a Marlon Brando. So we make a lot of noise on the weekends, and then we sort of go back to the chain gang Monday through Friday and watch our health insurance taken away. I think one of the things that we can cultivate is a healthy, neighborly, reasonable resistance to those things that are destroying our quality of life. And we can make that good kind of noise, which is protest. And then a third thing I think we can do, and I don't think it can be emphasized enough, although it sounds somewhat glib rolling off the tongue, is we can build stronger communities and get to know our neighbors better. A neighborhood in the deepest and the best sense is a very effective weapon against noise in a couple of ways, if you'll bear with me. First of all, If you know your neighbor, you're going to be more mindful of your own noise. You're also probably going to be a little bit more tolerant of his noise. The example I like to use is there's a young man who lives down the road from me who has a pretty loud truck, as young men sometimes do. And the sound of that truck, which he does not drive back and forth 100 times a day in front of my house, but the sound of that truck doesn't come to my ears as noise. It comes to my ears as the sound of a young man who, when I had pneumonia one winter, came by and plowed out my driveway faithfully because I could barely lean on a shovel. So that sound means to me that he's young and having a good time, and that's the way he likes to do it. And I also noticed that because he knows me, he doesn't rev it up when he goes by my house. He waits till he's down the road a little bit, and then he revs it up. The other thing, though, that knowing one's neighbors can do is when a noise source threatens a community that's larger than any device within that community, a large transportation source, a large industrial source, a large military source, and when these sorts of things get developed near communities, those pushing them through know very easily how to divide and conquer, how to enlist the resentment that's in the community against neighbors in order to make it easier to railroad these things through. A strong community, a community that has lived together, of people who've lived together with something like kindness, when they close ranks, they can resist forces many times themselves and sometimes successfully.
Garrett Keyser is the author of The Unwanted Sound of Everything We Want, a book about noise. He spoke with Steve Paulson. We have a favor to ask of you. We're working on a show about neighbors, and we want to hear your stories, short stories, about 2 minutes long. Go to our website to find out how to share your neighbor stories, ttbook.org. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast. You can buy a copy of the program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the program, Quiet, Please. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Doug Gordon, with help from Ann Strainchamps, Charles Monroe Kane, Sarah Nix, and Veronica Rickert. Special thanks to special guest engineer, Manya. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.